Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet him, greet him, treat him, and street him. Today's date is September 5th, 2018, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is Winds of Change, High-Flow Nasal Oxygen for Acute Bronchitis. And our guest skeptic is Dr. Ben Lawton. Ben is a pediatric emergency physician in Brisbane, Australia. He divides his time between a tertiary children's hospital and a community hospital that is busy enough to have its own pediatric emergency department. He's also part of that amazing team that runs Don't Forget the Bubble blog. Welcome to the SGEM, Ben.
Hi, Ken. Thanks for having me.
I have to tell you, I was so upset that I couldn't attend the Don't Forget the Bubbles 18 conference in Melbourne, Australia. Can you just give me some of the highlights from the meeting?
Yeah, definitely. Starting with a tough question, I think. We were really pleased that Stuart Dalziel and the group from Predict decided to release the results of their concept trial at the conference. And they've been looking at the difference between phenytoin and Keppra in status epilepticus. And really one of the highlights for me of the FTB is really just the atmosphere around the whole conference. We had some great speakers and a great atmosphere, and we missed you.
Well, you know, through social media, you know, sometimes you don't get the context, but I can tell you watching the Twitter feed, you had millions, I think, of Twitter impressions. You could actually get a sense of that community, that culture that you've created with Don't Forget the Bubbles. So I am really going to try to attend Don't Forget the Bubbles 19, but I don't have to go down under for that. You guys are moving the location.
That's right. Yeah. You've only got to fly across the pond to London.
Yeah, no, and I think my kids would love to go to that because they want to go on a Harry Potter tour and go through London and see all the different sites and stuff like that.
Sounds good.
All right, well, we're going to have to get started because winter is coming, and that means in Canada, bronchiolitis season is coming. So you've got a case for us.
Yeah, I do. So Elsie's 5 months old, and she presents on day two of a bronchiolitic illness. She's taken just under half of her usual feed so far on that day, and she's got a respiratory rate of 58 breaths a minute. Her oxygen saturation is 90% on room air, and she's got a moderate work of breathing at the moment. She's not clinically dehydrated, and she's got a temperature of 38.2 with some clear rhinorrhea. She's got red ears and a red throat, and she's got equal air entry on both sides with some widespread crackles and wheeze bilaterally. Elsie was born at term. She's immunized, and she's got no significant medical history. Her parents, Dave and Tony, have driven 20 minutes from home to bring her to the regional hospital where you work. Your hospital's got an inpatient pediatric ward, but it's a 90-minute drive from the nearest children's hospital with PICU facilities.
We've covered bronchiolitis before on SGEM number 167 with expert Dr. Amy Plint. And in that episode, we looked at how bronchiolitis was managed in the community hospitals. The bottom line was that there seems to be a knowledge gap when it comes to managing bronchiolitis in the community setting. But I should add there's also a knowledge gap when managing bronchiolitis in the large academic centers.
Yeah, that's right. And although the vast majority of infants with bronchiolitis can be managed with supportive care at home, because it's so common, because of its high incidence, it's the number one reason for infants to be hospitalized in lots of countries.
And since bronchiolitis is a clinical diagnosis, there's no test, including viral testing and radiography, which rules it in or out. Sadly, despite multiple guidelines, there is no, quote, magic bullet in terms of treatment.
There's not. Hypertonic saline has been tried for acute bronchiolitis. A systematic review of that treatment was covered in SGM 157, I think. The bottom line at that time was that data didn't support the routine use of hypertonic saline for mild to moderate acute bronchiolitis.
Well, the American Academy of Pediatric guidelines say that oxygen therapy in infants with saturations of 90% or greater may not be needed.
Yeah, they say that clinicians may choose not to administer supplemental oxygen if the oxyhemoglobin saturation exceeds 90% in infants and children with a diagnosis of bronchiolitis. But that's an level D level of evidence with only a weak recommendation.
So what's the clinical question then for today's podcast, Ben?
So the clinical question, will Elsie benefit from the use of heated, humidified high-flow oxygen via nasal prongs in preference to low-flow oxygen via standard nasal cannula?
And the reference for this is Franklin et al., a randomized trial of high-flow oxygen therapy in infants with bronchiolitis. And this was in the New England Journal of Medicine, March 2018. Let's run through the PICO. What was the population?
The population was infants less than 12 months of age with bronchiolitis who needed supplemental oxygen based on their institutional practice as to how they defined hypoxia.
Yeah, and they defined the bronchiolitis using the American Academy of Pediatrics criteria as symptoms of respiratory distress associated with symptoms of a viral respiratory tract infection. Now, they did have a number of exclusions, and I will list those in the show notes. What was the intervention?
The intervention was heated humidified high-flow oxygen given via nasal prongs at 2 liters per kilo per minute with a FiO2 that was titrated to maintain their oxygen saturations between 92 and 98% or 94 and 98% depending on the institutional practice.
And what did they compare it to?
They compared that to oxygen via standard nasal low-flow prongs, which was titrated to maintain an oxygen saturation in the same ranges.
Okay, let's look at the outcomes. What was their primary outcome?
That was treatment failure resulting in an escalation of care during hospital admission.
An escalation of care was defined as needing increased respiratory support or transfer to an ICU.
Treatment failure was defined by meeting 3 of 4 clinical criteria. Clinicians were permitted to escalate therapy if they were worried for other clinical reasons that weren't captured in the 4 clinical criteria, though.
Yeah, and the criteria were the heart rate unchanged or increased since admission, respiratory rate was unchanged or increased since admission, the FiO2 requirement exceeded 0.4 on high flow or 2 liters per minute on low flow to main oxygen saturation within that targeted range, or the fourth thing was hospital early warning tool. How about their secondary outcomes?
They were the proportion of infants transferred to an ICU, the duration of hospital stay, the duration of ICU stays, the duration of oxygen therapy, the intubation rates, the adverse event rates. Adverse events were defined as anything that was fatal, life-threatening, permanently disabling, or resulted in a prolonged hospital stay.
So the author's conclusions were, quote, among infants with bronchiolitis treated outside the ICU, those who received high-flow oxygen therapy had significantly lower rates of escalation of care due to treatment failure than those in the group that received standard oxygen therapy, end of quote. All right, Ben, let's run through the quality checklist for randomized trials, and there's 11 questions. You ready to go?
I'm ready.
Okay, let's go. 1, the study population included or focused on those in the emergency department?
Yes, it did. The patients were recruited from emergency departments, but also from pediatric wards as well.
2, the patients were adequately randomized?
Yes, they were.
3, the randomization process was concealed?
Yes, it was.
The patients were analyzed in the groups to which they were randomized?
Yes, they were. The complicating factor there was that the low flow failures or the failures in the control group were escalated to high flow or escalated to the intervention effectively, with 167 patients in the study switching from low flow to high flow and no one going the other way around. These were counted as treatment failures, though, which was appropriate.
5, the study patients were recruited consecutively?
Yes, they were.
Were both groups similar with respect to prognostic factors?
Yes.
7, all participants were unaware of group allocations?
No, it wasn't possible to blind them because of the visually obvious nature of the intervention.
8, all groups were treated equally except for the intervention?
Yes, they were.
Was the follow-up complete?
Yes, 10% were lost between randomization and analysis, but they were roughly equal in both groups.
10, all patient-important outcomes were considered?
I'm not sure. It would have been nice to see a comment on the patient comfort and the family perceptions of care, but I think that's coming in a future paper.
And for quality checklists for randomized clinical trials, we don't have 10 questions. We go to 11. So the 11th question, the treatment effect was large enough and precise enough to be clinically significant.
I think it was, yeah. This is the largest data set that we have and really is the best thing that we've got to go on with heated humidified high flow in kids of that age with bronchiolitis. So it's large enough to be clinically significant. I think the precision, I'm not sure about.
All right, let's run through the key results then. They enrolled almost 1,500 patients with acute bronchiolitis with about half assigned to standard oxygen therapy with nasal prongs and the other half to receive the high flow oxygen therapy. The mean age was 6 months and just over 1/3 were female.
Yeah, treatment failure was 12% in the high-flow oxygen therapy group versus 23% in the low-flow oxygen therapy comparison group.
So with that primary outcome, which was defined as treatment failure resulting in an escalation of care, they had 12%, like you said, with the high flow versus 23% with the low flow having treatment failure. So that gave a risk difference of 11%.
And a number needed to treat of 9 to prevent one episode of escalation of care.
And how about the secondary outcomes?
There were no significant differences in duration of hospital stay, in duration of ICU stay, or duration of oxygen therapy.
Yeah, the high-flow oxygen therapy was used as a rescue therapy, like you mentioned previously, in 167 infants in the standard care group who required escalation of care. Now, 61% of those infants responded to the high-flow as a rescue therapy.
Yeah. Now, 12 infants required intubation, and 8 of those were from the high-flow group and 4 from the low-flow group. So high-flow didn't prevent intubation within the study cohort, which was interesting.
And there was no difference in adverse event rates with one pneumothorax in each group. Well, those are the main results. Ben, you ready to talk nerdy?
I am.
Okay. Well, we had the good fortune to connect with our FOMED friend in Australia, Jesse Spurr, and he happened to be hanging out with the lead author of this paper. Her name is Dr. Donna Franklin, and he reached out to Donna Franklin on our behalf and connected us, and she was kind enough to include written responses to our nerdy questions. So we'll read out our nerdy points, and then in the blog, we will put in her responses to our nerdy questions. And I've got the first one here, Ben. So the first thing I'm going to talk about is objective versus subjective clinical criteria. There were actually 5 clinical criteria to trigger an escalation of care. You needed 3 or more criteria to trigger that escalation. 3 of the criteria were very objective. Okay, what's the heart rate? What's the respiratory rate? Let's look at the oxygen requirements. But there was one fuzzy criteria because different hospitals use different early warning tools. And these early warning tools could trigger a single or multi-trigger, meaning a rise of a single vital sign, like the heart rate alone, would trigger an escalation of care, but not others, thereby ticking off 2 of the 4 boxes. Now, the 5th clinical criteria was subjective. It was if the clinician's spidey senses were tingling. And I understand why they included clinical gestalt, but it would have been made it easier to interpret if they had just used objective criteria or been pragmatic and said, if the clinician's worried, that's enough for us, escalation of care.
Now, there's been some debate about what constitutes high flow, with some trials using a liter per kilo or other flow rates. Paris provides a data set around a way of using and defining high flow, which is defensible as any standard in this area. In other words, it's now a strong argument that we should accept standard high flow as meaning flow of 2 liters per kilo per minute, with titrated FiO2 from 0.21 and up from there. We know that the adverse event rates don't increase up to an FiO2 of 0.4, so we can argue that children being managed within these parameters should be cared for on standard wards with standard nursing ratios, unless there are other contextual factors which make this problematic.
The third nerdy point was about the composite outcome. Their primary outcome was escalation of care, but it was a composite outcome. It included either requiring more respiratory support or transfer to an ICU. For the standard oxygen therapy group, it meant being moved to high-flow oxygen therapy. When you looked at the individual outcomes, there were no differences in the transfer to an ICU. Therefore, the difference in the composite outcome was driven by moving low-flow patients to high-flow therapy.
Now, with the escalation of care was twice as likely to occur in hospitals without an on-site PICU versus hospitals with a PICU, so 7% versus 14%. Not using a PICU bed has significant cost savings, and it's nicer for the family not to be in PICU, but arguably it's not as disruptive for the family than being transferred to a whole other hospital. Though a study on family experience of care would be good, and I think it's coming later. Transfers are both expensive and disruptive to families. So on a system or economic level, high flow may be disproportionately useful in hospitals that don't have a PICU.
The 5th point was about secondary outcomes. None of the secondary outcomes were statistically different. Transfer to an ICU, duration of hospital stay, duration of ICU stay, duration of oxygen therapy, and intubation rates. These seem very patient-oriented compared to escalation of care.
Yeah. With the intubation rates, the lack of difference in intubation rates was odd on the face of it, because anecdotally, we're intubating noticeably fewer kids with bronchiolitis than we did before the widespread use of high-flow oxygen. A difference may have been lost in the fact that all the patients in the standard group who required escalation were put on high flow. So it's possible that without high flow as a rescue therapy, the intubation rate would have been much higher. But there's no way to know this.
The seventh point is about the lack of blinding that you mentioned earlier. The two different oxygen supplementation setups were different and obvious. This means the study was unblinded. It could have introduced some bias, especially given the subjective criteria that was part of the escalation of care. It is unclear which direction this potential bias, due to the lack of blinding, would have influenced the results.
The eighth point was about the external validity. So with the parameters defined by the trial, as in a flow rate of 2 liters per kilo per minute, with an FiO2 of less than 0.4, there was no increase in adverse events with high flow oxygen, with a nursing ratio of 1 to 4. Nursing ratios of 1 to 2 were required until fairly recently in many places, and they'd prevent the use of high flow in many contexts because it blocked too many beds, leading to pressure for the child to be transferred anyway. But these nursing ratios seem unnecessary based on Paris. Now, it's important to note that Paris came with paediatric nurse educator support provided by the trial team at no cost to the hospital. Many non-tertiary facilities do not have access to specialised paediatric nurse educator support, and it would be important to observe for any increase in adverse events due to differences in nursing education capacity as high-flow oxygen is implemented outside of the trial.
All right, the ninth nerdy point is about oxygen saturation. This study had different oxygen saturation targets, 92 to 98% at some institutions or 94 to 98% at other institutions. Now, periods of hypoxia have been documented in healthy infants with saturations as low as 84 to 86%. Do these targets actually matter, or should we just allow lower oxygen saturations before providing supplemental oxygen?
Well, the AAP gives a weak recommendation based on low-level evidence that supplementary oxygen may not be administered if the level's above 90%. The bronchiolitis of Infancy Discharge Summary, or BIDS, demonstrated equivalence in their primary outcome, which was time to resolution of cough, between a minimum target oxygen saturation of at least 90% versus over 94%. Those in the modified group, or with a minimum target of at least 90%, were fit for discharge sooner. They were off oxygen one day sooner, and they were actually discharged 10 hours earlier than the standard group.
Xu et al. Published a sneaky randomized control trial in JAMA back in 2014, on hospitalization of infants with bronchiolitis. They took patients with mild to moderate bronchiolitis and true oxygen saturations of greater than 87%. And then they randomized them to have a true oxygen reading or an altered reading of 3% higher than the true reading. Very sneaky. And the primary outcome was hospitalization within 3 days. Those with artificially elevated pulse oximetry were less likely to be admitted to hospital within 3 days. This finding suggests that other factors besides oxygen saturation should be used in determining the management of infants with bronchiolitis.
It does. And there was also the study by Principi and colleagues in JAMA in 2016 that looked at desaturation of infants with bronchiolitis who were discharged home. It showed that a majority of infants actually had hypoxic episodes or oxygen saturations of less than 90% for at least a minute. Of the infants who had desaturation events, the vast majority had oxygen levels less than 80%, and more than a third had less than 70% for at least a minute. However, there was no difference in unscheduled return medical visits and delayed hospitalizations between infants that had desaturations and those who didn't.
So do these oxygen values really matter? And what oxygen level should we use? Certainly oxygen saturation should not be the only factor in making management decisions for patients with acute bronchiolitis.
And point 10, failure. The primary outcome, as mentioned, was escalation of care or transfer to an ICU, which was a failure of a treatment. There was no difference in transfers to the ICU in this study. It'd be totally reasonable, based on the results of this trial, to adopt a policy of putting infants on low-flow oxygen initially, with escalation to high-flow as the first thing to do once they've triggered those predetermined clinical criteria. How you attach the low-flow prongs to the infant's worth thinking about to avoid the need to pull the tape off the child's face in order to change the prongs should they need an escalation to high-flow.
And I want to drill down on those numbers just a little bit more in order to make a point. Now, we mentioned that 167 patients who failed standard therapy with low flow, 100% of them were put on high flow. Of those, 61% improved, representing 14% of the overall patients in the standard group. This means that 65 out of 167 patients, or 39%, did not improve and were transferred to the ICU. Therefore, 65 out of 733, or 9%, of patients started on nasal prongs were escalated to high-flow oxygen therapy and ultimately ended up in the ICU. Now, here's the interesting point. Remember that 12%, or 87 out of the 739 of the patients randomized to the high-flow group were admitted to the ICU. So now you have to consider that that NNT of 9, the interpretation could be that 9 infants would need to be put on high-flow oxygen therapy to do what? To prevent one infant from being putting on high-flow oxygen therapy later on, with no difference in ICU admission. So does this actually represent a failure? And how much equipment, time, and staff would be needed for this intervention? Would it not be more practical just to put everybody on low flow and only transition those to high flow if needed? All right, let's get on to the comments. And this is the comments on the author's conclusions and compare them to the SGEM's conclusions.
So the authors concluded that high-flow oxygen therapy reduces the need for escalation of care, and that's reasonable. And the parameters that they've chosen as denoting a need for escalation in the trial actually reflect parameters around which clinical management and resource use would commonly be affected in clinical contexts where early warning tools are used. So they would have triggered a medical emergency team response. Within the system that I work, this would reduce resource use. It's not clear that the escalation that this trial avoids actually benefits these patients. Or in other words, we might have just drawn an artificial line and then found a therapy that helps us stay on the right side of that line, forgetting that the line had no real meaning in the first place. The authors have neither shown nor claimed that high-flow oxygen therapy makes bronchiolitis better any quicker.
Okay, Ben, give us a bottom line.
So my bottom line would be that high-flow oxygen therapy is not required for every child in hospital with bronchiolitis. It'll continue to have a role in supporting those with more severe disease, but the potential benefits and harms will need to be considered within the context of where it's being used.
So what are you going to do about Elsie, that little child that came in?
Well, Elsie was commenced on low-flow oxygen via nasal prongs at 1 litre a minute. The flow was increased to 1.5 litres a minute on day 4, and then it was weaned over the 5th day, and she was discharged home on day 6. She started daycare 3 weeks later and currently has a runny nose. So Dave and Tony are keeping a careful eye on her work of breathing.
So how are you going to take this Paris trial that was published by Franklin and her colleagues, and how are you going to apply it clinically?
Well, I think we haven't found a magic bullet for bronchiolitis. High-flow oxygen for treating bronchiolitis in infants is associated with no increase in adverse events and is probably useful in enabling moderately unwell children with bronchiolitis to be cared for outside of an intensive care unit in most developed healthcare systems where pediatric early warning scores are used. It doesn't make any difference to the rate of recovery, though. There may well be benefits in terms of cost and family experience in some contexts, but these haven't been adequately explored yet.
So what are you going to tell the patient? But, you know, I guess in this case, it's going to be to her parents.
So I'm going to tell Elsie's parents that Elsie needs some more help with her breathing and that we'll start with some oxygen through nasal prongs. And if she gets worse, we can try her on some high flow later.
All right, it's time for the Keener Contest, and last week's winner was Dr. Stephen Stelt, and he's an emergency specialist from Auckland, New Zealand. And Ben, that's just like Australia, right? Australia, New Zealand, there's, you know, it's the same, right? Canadian, American.
It's just over the bridge.
Yeah, yeah. All right, well, he knew that it was Dr. Perry Cox from Scrubs who once said to his junior colleague, quite rudely, "Are you a real doctor or a doctor like Dr. Pepper is a doctor?" What question do you have this week?
So this week's question is, what company patented the concept of heated humidified high-flow therapy via nasal cannula in 1988 after it being developed for use in racehorses?
In racehorses?
Indeed.
In racehorses. Okay, well, if you know the answer, then send me it to thesgem at gmail.com and put Keener in the subject line so I can pick it out of my email. And the first correct response will receive a cool skeptical prize. Well, Ben, thanks very much for being the Don't Forget the Bubbles guest skeptic on this episode.
Thanks for having me, Ken.
I hope we can do more collaboration. I love putting FOMED friends together. So I hope we can collaborate more on future episodes. And okay, I got to put that. What's the date in 2019 for Don't Forget the Bubbles? You got that?
It's the 17th to the 19th of June in London.
So the 17th to the 19th, June 2019. Save the date. Until then, can you say the tagline?
I can. Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to everyone next week.